the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
So this morning, we're going to start a new series about following Jesus and what it actually means to be a disciple. But before we start into it, just a quick advert. We're going to talk about Luke 5, 1-11, and the title this morning is Called to Follow. What does it mean to be called to follow Jesus? Before we do that, just advance notice of something that's coming up soon. Not till February the 20th, is when it starts, but that will be the next of our quote-unquote Christianity courses. We need a different name for those now. We did one last term based on the Yesterday's Hero thing about who Jesus was, and it was exciting to have people there who are not Christians, aren't young in their faith and don't understand an awful lot about it, asking really basic and wonderful questions about the whole thing. Now, one of the things I did last time was to get to ask people if they would come and be part of it with me. And it was brilliant to have Stephen Jones there and John Fox helping me lead the whole thing. I didn't give them much to do because I'd start talking and then nobody else gets a chance. But they were brilliant, especially the final session was just great when Stephen just shared what had happened to him in coming to faith. People were just absolutely riveted by the whole thing. And John, well, he's done this kind of thing so many times before. He's a real wise pair of eyes and hands to have around, and he did a fabulous job. And it just makes me realize more and more that if we're going to see this kind of thing work, that people become Christians through the small group courses that we do, we need to get many more people involved in it. First of all, praying for it, which is why I'm talking about it this morning. Please pray ahead to February the 20th. We have a few weeks in which we can put in some serious prayer time for those who are going to be involved. Second, in inviting people, but third as well, in training in how to actually do it. Because you can use these materials with just one other person if you want, over a cup of coffee in your house. Go to Costa or Starbucks or somewhere. This is not advertising, other coffee shops are available. But, you know, Just do it wherever you can. And if you begin to realize just how simple it is to use this easy means of introducing what you really think is important to somebody who isn't yet convinced about it, wow, it gets exciting. So anyway, there's my advert. Let's start the talk proper. This is Thomas Huxley. He was a friend of Charles Darwin back in the 19th century, and he was a busy boy. He was known as Darwin's Rottweiler, and he used to go around savaging people who didn't believe in Darwin's idea of evolution. So he frequently had lots of talks and addresses to give. And there's one day when he was staying at a hotel, and he had to catch the train very, very quickly to get to his next appointment. So he went to the hotel doorman and said, get me a cab, I've got to go to the station. And the doorman had said, done this many times before, so he says, yes, Mr. Huxley, okay. And the cab duly appeared. And Huxley jumped in, assuming that the doorman had said, this is for the station, and just said, I want you to drive really fast. We're not going to catch it unless we really move now, really fast. And so the doorman, the driver, started off at a gallop down the street. And Huxley thought, after a couple of streets, hang on a minute, we're going the wrong way. This is not the way to the station. So he tapped on the window and stuck his head round and said to the cab driver, do you know where we're going? And the driver said, no, but I'm driving really fast. Too easy to do that, isn't it? If you don't know where you're going, it doesn't matter how fast you're going. And I think there are churches in the world that are a bit like that, that are doing lots of stuff, that are super busy. And if we're not careful, we can be one of those churches that goes really fast, does lots of stuff, and doesn't really know what it's about. That's why we want to come back to this word about being a disciple this year, and have a look through the Gospel of Luke at all of the things that come out of that. If you want to do more about the Gospel of Luke, come tonight. We're going to read vast chunks of it together. And that's exciting because, this morning, 11 verses, that's not a lot, is it? There's a lot more that Luke said. And sometimes looking at the whole thing as one, reading lots of it together, puts things into place for you in a way that wouldn't happen otherwise. So do come tonight if you can. But one way or another, we're going to be tangling with Luke right through this year, if we can do it, and finding out a bit more about discipleship. There was a great church leader, a very original man in New Zealand in the 1980s and 1990s called Brian Hathaway. He's now died, sadly, but he was just a brilliant thinker. And once he was asked to do a series on discipleship, and he phoned up 24 ministers in New Zealand, and they were all ministers of churches where he knew people were becoming converted, where lots of evangelistic projects were running. And he said, I asked them about their discipleship programs and whether they would be prepared to share with others at the Congress what they were doing. And first he said, how's your evangelism going? Oh, great, fantastic. We're seeing people becoming Christians. We've got this marvelous project going on. We've got this series planned. Oh, you've got no idea what's going on in our church. And then he asked them, so how about discipleship? I would get hesitant answers such as, well, we put our new converts into home groups, or yes, we take our new Christians through a series of Bible studies. When I asked if this was discipleship, there was often another embarrassed silence. He said, I found it exceptionally hard to find anybody who was prepared to deal with this topic. I've come to the sad conclusion that there's a huge gap in the discipling programs in most evangelistic churches in our nation, and the level of disciple making is abysmally low. Now, he's a New Zealander, so he's a fisherman, and he said this, one of the problems with discipleship is that it's a long, painful, and costly process. You can't just count heads as you can in evangelism, and it takes years to assess in terms of results. It reminds me very much of fishing. It's easy to catch fish. Cleaning them is the problem. We've often overlooked the fact that the New Testament has a lot more to say about the kind of community the church ought to be before the world than it has to say about its mission to the world. There's no point in bringing people to Christ unless you're going to complete the job and make them disciples. So we tried as a leadership team a little while ago to put together one paragraph that would express what we wanted Belmont Chapel to be shooting for this year. Here it goes. This coming year, we want to get back to the roots of what being a disciple really means and dig out some key principles we can embed more firmly in our lives. We want to explore what it means to follow Jesus individually, but also what it means to be his followers together, and discover how, in our circumstances, we can enrich and nourish one another's lives more, encourage and develop one another's experience, and extend that out into the wider circle which we're in contact with, those with whom we have a good relationship, but who aren't fully committed to following Jesus yet. We want to see how we can best develop the relationships we have with those people, friends, colleagues, acquaintances, users of Belmont activities, so that we can maximize the ways in which the love of Christ and the challenge of following him become ever more apparent and attractive to them through our lives. In that way, the church will grow, the values of God's kingdom will become ever more apparent through our lifestyle, and together we'll grow more confidently into the love of Christ. That is where we want to go this year. So let's look at this whole subject of disciples in the verses we've read this morning. The first question I want to ask is, how did Jesus actually call people? Oh, it's too far down the screen. Ah, never mind. What it says at the bottom, how did Jesus call them to be disciples? Okay. Oh, he spent hours making this thing and then, never mind. Okay, fair enough. Let's just move on from there. Oops. Stuck as well. That's good. There's a process in this. When you read Luke chapter 5, if you didn't read anything else, you might get the impression that Jesus in his heavenly nightgown floats down to the riverside, teaches a little bit, and then says to people, follow me. And you go, yes, master. And they just go and follow him like that. It wasn't quite like that. This was not the first time that Jesus had talked to these guys. If you put together Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, you'll find four slightly different accounts of how it all started. And when you piece it together, it goes a bit like this. The first thing that happens, John records this one, is that Simon, Andrew, Philip, and Nathaniel meet Jesus. And they're impressed by him in different ways, for different reasons. And they start realizing, this could just be the one we've been waiting for. But they don't leave their jobs or anything like that. They just start hanging around with Jesus, watching his style, learning a bit about him. And then there comes a day, and Matthew and Mark talk about this, when Jesus comes to Peter, Andrew, James, and John as they're at their job as fishermen and says, I want you now to start seriously following me. And they do. But that doesn't mean they leave their job. They just spend more time with Jesus. They become a bit more committed. They start telling other people about him. Well, Andrew was already at that right from the start. But, they just get a little bit more committed. And then in Luke 5, in our passage, this is a bit that we're reading this morning, they finally leave everything behind to follow Jesus. No more fishing, off we go. As a result, things start to happen. Others are also called. And people like Matthew, for instance, sitting there as a tax gatherer at his desk, is approached by Jesus. Jesus locks eyes with him and says, you're going to follow me, aren't you? Yeah, I am. But it's all people, you see, that Jesus has had some contact with. They've got to know him. They understand what he's asking for. They're not just responding emotionally, yes, yes, take me now. It's not that kind of stuff. It's something they've thought about a little bit. Then there are volunteers who apply to join as well. Master, I'll come with you. I'll do whatever you want. And often they've not thought it through. And Jesus says, can you really take it? Can you? But the group starts to grow. And Jesus eventually prays overnight about who he should pick particularly to be closest to him. And ends up commissioning 12 of them, including some of those original boys, as the apostles who are going to be with him all the time. So you see, this passage we're looking at this morning is the tipping point. This is where the Jesus movement really starts getting underway. This is the crucial decision. If Peter and the others here had said, nah, thanks, but no thanks, Jesus' ministry would have had a real difficulty in getting started. This was the crucial point. Up until this point, they'd had time to get to know him, to understand what discipleship was all about. But now it was time to take a step forward, to do something they'd never done before. After this, it all started rolling with great speed, and the whole thing took off incredibly. But this was the crucial point that we're looking at this morning. And so it teaches us two things, I think, about discipleship. First of all, that discipleship is a gradual process, not a once-for-all leap into the unknown. And it's true that God can save a man or a woman on the spot. It isn't wrong that evangelists stand up in front of mass audiences in auditoria and say, I want you to come forward right now. I want you to raise your hand. I want you to accept Jesus Christ right where you are. If you came on the coach, it will wait for you. And all the rest of it, you've been there. It's not wrong that they do that, because sometimes that's the kind of thing that provokes decision in people. But unless that decision is followed up by a process of understanding what it's all about, a process of growing as a disciple, it ain't really discipleship. The second thing, though, is, and yet, there are crisis moments when we make a big choice. There are people I've seen, I'm sure you have as well, whose Christian lives have been okay, but fairly dormant, fairly unexciting, who suddenly taken a leap forward, and it's as if they've been converted all over again. Discipleship is a kind of stop-go process for most of us. We learn a bit, and we learn a bit more, and we learn a bit more. Challenges come in, and at different points, there are crisis decisions to be made. One of the guys who is one of my heroes, and I quoted him many times to Belmont over the years, is George Verwer, who founded Operation Mobilization. He once said this: C.S. Lewis said that we have the tendency to think and feel, but not to act. If we go on feeling and thinking but not acting, then one day we will be unable to act. Well, now, Brother George doesn't always reference his quotations, and I remember hearing that when I was about 20, and I spent nearly 50 years now looking for the source of that quotation in the works of C.S. Lewis. Can't find it. I suspect George made it up, or, you know, without realizing. But one way or another, it's absolutely right, isn't it? We have the tendency to think and feel, but not take action on it. And the end result is that you can sit in an evangelical church for years and have your head regularly stuffed, Sunday by Sunday, with more information about the Bible, more challenges, more thoughts about what you ought to do, which you never actually put into practice. And the more you think without acting, the less becomes your capacity to act. You've got to do something about it. And for most of us, that means taking a decision to move ahead at some point. And then that decision needs to be followed up by a process. Another of George's famous statements, and he definitely came up with this one because this is pure George, is a crisis not followed by a process soon becomes an abscess. Not a pretty picture, but you get the impression. Crises are all right. They're ways of moving forward. But a process needs to follow from there. So, for the rest of the time we've got this morning, I just want to talk about three questions. And the first of those, which will not be on the screen, you're right, it's not on the screen, is what does it mean to be a disciple? What is discipleship anyway? And I think there are three things involved, mainly, if you look back at what a disciple meant in the days of Jesus. It's often been said that there are three parts to your personality. There's your mind, which you think with. There's your will, that you make decisions with. And there are your emotions, that you feel with. And all three of those parts of your personality are involved in any big decision you make. For example, when you fall in love with the person of the opposite sex whom you're going to spend all of your life with, or whatever, your emotions are probably the first thing that's going to be involved. You see this wonderful person across a crowded concourse at Belmont in coffee time, and something inside you goes, ah. And the air goes kind of pink, and it's as if the worship band is playing with violins in the background, you know. And emotionally, you're hooked. But if this is going to be a lasting relationship, first of all, your mind is going to be involved. You've got to get together with that person, spend some time with them, get to know them, find out if you tick on the same level. And it can take hours, can't it? I remember when my eldest daughter got her first boyfriend, and he'd come round to her house in the evening. And about 10 o'clock, I'd say, is that the time, 10 o'clock? Isn't it time you were going home, Tim? And unwillingly, he'd say, yeah, all right, fair enough. And he'd go out to the doorstep, and Catherine would say, I'll just go out with him. Yeah, all right, fair enough. And he'd spend the next half hour on the doorstep. And I'd be sitting there saying to my wife, what are they doing out there? What's going on? I thought that boy was going home. And she'd say, oh, relax, you know what we were like. And yeah, that's what worries me. And eventually you get rid of him. But they weren't doing anything. They'd just be talking. And that's what you do, isn't it? You mentally adjust to one another as well. And then eventually, if it all goes well, as they come, when you stand in front of here or wherever it happens to be, and somebody with a big black book says, will you take this person to be your lawful wedded forever? And you say, I will, you know, or whatever. And that's when it happens, isn't it? Your will is involved as well. And in making a successful relationship, you've got to be committed. I will spend my life with this person. I will not fall out with him when he fails to take the rubbish out. I will. And it's a matter of willpower that keeps you going, isn't it? My wife is nodding vigorously in the background there. But anyhow, that's what's involved in any important decision you make. Now, with discipleship, it's exactly the same. If you became a disciple in those days, first of all, you had to learn to learn. The disciple of a rabbi learned to look at the scriptures in the way that his leader did, learned to interpret them as the rabbi did, learned to find out a way of approaching scripture that fitted it all together. And that's one thing that Christians have got to do. They've got to learn how to feed on the word of God, how to handle it, how to put it at the very center of their lives. But your will is involved as well, and you'll learn to live. Not just to take on board the information, but as we've already been saying, to do something about it, to live it out in daily, practical, costly action. And sometimes the things you will do will make other people say, that's not normal. Normal people don't behave like that. Well, usual people don't behave like that. But the normal way of living, the way that the Bible teaches, makes an awful lot more sense. People don't always see it that way. And so the disciples of a rabbi in those days would copy the rabbi pretty closely. There's even a story in the Jewish scriptures about the two disciples of a rabbi who one night hid behind the drapes in his bedroom as he got undressed, because he wanted to observe in what order he took his clothes off. Because if your rabbi took the right sock off before he took the left sock off, you didn't want to take the left sock off first. So it got that detailed. They just wanted to be just like their rabbi. Once upon a time, when John Stott was the most influential preacher in the Anglican evangelical churches, it was said that you could tell from listening to young preachers who'd been listening to John Stott, because he sounded just like him. They used the same 3 points, they used the same stories, even the intonation of the voice sounded just the same. They just wanted to be like the teacher. And so learning to live is part of it as well. And then your emotions, learning to love. Because disciples in those days weren't solo learners. They were involved in a band of disciples. And when Jesus called these people to full commitment, they knew what that involved. Leaving their fishing boats behind, going off with him, forming a community in which they would have to live with people who were unlike themselves. I mean, think of the 12 characters involved in that bunch of apostles. My goodness. And they would have to learn how to share a common purse, how to sleep on the hills at night when they had nowhere to sleep, all of that sort of stuff. They had to learn to be a community together. And I reckon those 3 things are still true. A disciple needs to learn to learn. He needs to learn to live. And she needs to learn to love. All 3 things are important if you want to be a disciple. There's another one too. If you want to keep it going, you need to learn to listen. And as you watch the disciples going around following Jesus, again and again you see them tailing behind him saying, what did he mean by that? What do you think that was? Why did he say that? And It's not just a once-for-all thing, the big crisis moment. It's the process, too, of learning to go on listening to the voice of Jesus as time goes by, as he leads you into one adventure after another. That's what discipleship is really about. Next unreadable question, then, is the question, what made them decide on this occasion here that they wanted to follow Jesus? What did they actually do? What happened to them? And I think, once again, in the story, I can see three different things. First of all, there was a confirming experience. When Jesus came to them by the lakeside in Matthew and Mark and just said, "Follow me," that was all he said. Here he did something different. He started teaching a crowd. When the crowd got too big, he got into the boat and pulled out a little bit from the side so that he had a natural floating pulpit and they were all arranged across the sand. And then he said, "Pull out into the deep and start catching fish." And as John's already told us, it seemed crazy to the disciples. And Peter says, "Master, that's daft, but never mind. Because you say it, I will do it." And suddenly, the greatest catch of fish they've ever seen. In broad daylight. That wasn't when you went fishing. Do you remember, at the end of the Gospels, after Jesus has risen again, the disciples say, "What do we do now? Let's go fishing." And they do it overnight. And it's in the morning that they meet Jesus on the shore, and he makes breakfast for them. The night was a time when you went fishing. Not the middle of the morning. Give us a break. But actually, when they put the nets down, they had that experience through which Jesus was saying to them, "Listen, it may not make sense to you, but if it makes sense to me, you will find that I can meet all of your needs if you just do what I say. I'll get you doing crazy things. I'll send you to places you would never have gone to on your own. But you will find that all of your needs are not just met, but overflowingly met." And so through this experience, they were ready to follow him a bit more. Second was an overwhelming awe. Peter, who was always the spokesman for the disciples, comes to Jesus straight after, falls down in the boat and says, "Lord, I can't handle this. Go away. Depart from me." You think, that's a bit strange, isn't it? But then he gives you the clue. He says, "For I am a sinful man, O Lord." He begins to realize he's in the presence of an awesome power and a purity and a holiness that he just cannot handle. It's as if Jesus is all he's ever wanted, but he's just too dangerous. C.S. Lewis captures that brilliantly in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, where one of the girls finds out that Aslan is actually a lion and not a man. And she says, "Oh, you've been talking about this king as if he's a man, but actually he's a lion. Is he safe?" And Mr. Beaver says, "Safe? Don't you hear what Mrs. Beaver tells you? Who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe, but he's good. He's a king, I tell you." And that's the way it is with Jesus, isn't it? He's not safe. You don't know what he's going to do with you next. You put your life into his hands and it's not your own anymore. But it's good. It's brilliant. He's the one who knows best. And so Peter had this incredible sense that he was in the presence of something incredibly dangerous and yet incredibly good, incredibly committed to him. He realized that this awesome power came from somebody who knew him through and through and loved him just the same. And the third thing that pitchforks people into an experience of discipleship, well, it's a compelling vision. "Come on with me," says Jesus, "and you will catch people." And the word he uses for fishing for people, catching people, really means stopping them in their tracks, arresting them, making them do something different. And these disciples start to realize we can change the course of people's lives. We can either, mess about on the lake for the rest of our time, creating breakfast for a bunch of hungry villagers, or we can go into the world and change the whole course of history through the one person whom God has sent, who is going to be the pivot of history, who changes everything from one desperate situation to a new situation of promise and hope. And it was this compelling vision that made them just leave everything and go and follow Jesus. So we reach the third incomprehensible question, and this is just it. How do you get started? How do people get into discipleship like this? Well, I think, again, you see there were three things they did. First of all, they drew their boats up on the shore. Then they forsook everything. They said, "I'm leaving and I'm not coming back. You can have my best coat because I won't need it anymore," and so on and so forth. And they followed Jesus. They didn't know where they were going. They didn't know what it was about, but they knew that he was in charge, and wherever he was going, they were going. That tells you three things, doesn't it? First of all, they did it deliberately. It wasn't just, as I say, the Svengali-like kind of, "Oh, let's follow Jesus, let's go, whatever happens." What about your boats? Oh, never mind, burn them for firewood. I'm just following Jesus. No, they pulled up the boats on the shore. They got everything in order. That was why they were able to go fishing again, you know, after Jesus had died and resurrected. They left their affairs in order. They thought about this. They took a serious decision to go forward. They weren't swept into something on some kind of emotional cloud. They knew exactly what they were doing. They did it deliberately. And if you and I are going to get anywhere in following Jesus more deeply, more effectively, more profoundly this year, it's going to be because of a reckoning, because we've counted the cost, because we've worked out what it's going to take to be that way. Second, they did it completely. No reserve, nothing kept back, no plan B in case it all went wrong. They just said, right, I'm yours, I'm going your way, and that's it. And that again is what God might be demanding of us if we're really going to know what the discipleship of Jesus is all about this year. And third, they followed him. They did it unconditionally. Where are we going tonight? What's he going to do next? You just never know. Is he going to produce more fish? If so, he better produce a warehouse as well. He better invent deep freezings and things like that. Maybe it's not more miracles. Maybe he's going to heal the sick. Maybe he's going to teach parables. Maybe we're going to Jerusalem. Maybe we're going to Jericho. Who knows? Only one person knows, and that's Jesus. He's in charge. And when you give your life to him, it may well go, and I say this on my own experience, in a completely different direction from the one that you would have chosen for yourself. But you know what? When you look back on it, I speak to you as a very old person, when you look back on it, you find it was the best way you could possibly have gone. And God pulls out of your life all sorts of things that you never knew were there, stretching you, challenging you, building you, making you more like Jesus as time goes by, and satisfying you in a way that no other plan for living ever will satisfy. And so they did it unconditionally. Let me just end with a little story here about a part of India called Assam. There it is. You might just see the yellow circle up near the top there. It's south of Tibet and north of Bangladesh, and it's an area where there and in the provinces around it, Nagaland and Meghalaya and Manipur, there's a higher percentage of Christians than anywhere else in India. Wasn't always that way, though. It's a beautiful country. But up until the 1870s, nobody there really knew anything much about Jesus. And then a few missionaries started getting through, and they spread the message in some of the villages. And there was one Welsh missionary, around about 1880, who went to a small village up in the tea planting country in Assam, brilliant landscape, where he found very, very hard to get his message to make sense to the people. But one family in one village connected with it straight away and said, yep, this is what we've been waiting to hear all of our lives. And they became Christians. Now, that profoundly disturbed the rest of the village, and they decided that these people had to be shocked out of it. And so the day came when they surrounded them, and the village men who were archers had their bows at the ready, and it was obvious this was a very threatening situation. And they said, listen, unless you give up this new foreign faith you have adapted, we are going to kill you. And the rest of the family looked at the husband. It was a wife and two boys apart from him. And he said one thing. He said, I have decided to follow Jesus, and there is no turning back. There was a whistle. Two arrows flew through the air, and his two sons fell dead at his feet. He looked at his wife, but he could see that she was just as resolved as he was, and so he said something else. The world can be behind me, but the cross is still before me. Another whistle, and his wife fell down dead. And he realized that if he didn't back down now, he was going to be dead himself. And he simply said this, though no one is here to go with me, still I will follow Jesus. The only Christians in the village were dead. It was 5 years after that the Welsh missionary came back to see what had happened and heard the story of their martyrdom, and found that in that village over the last 5 years, almost everybody had come to faith in Christ because the bravery they had shown, the commitment that had come through their lifestyle, the memories people had of just how much they'd changed since they'd found Jesus had made everybody just cry out to God, look, if you're there, if you're real, we want to know this Jesus person. And that was the start of the tremendous revival throughout Nagaland and Assam, which led to so many churches being planted and so many people finding faith. We know a lot about it because Sadhu Sundar Singh, the great Indian Christian, heard the story and decided to set the words that the man had said to an old Indian folk tune, a lovely tune which we're not going to sing this morning, actually. We're going to sing a very inferior 21st century version, but hey, it's Ruth's choice, and what can I say? Have a word with her afterwards. But the words are absolutely brilliant, and to sum up what we've been talking about, let's sing those words right now.